From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, the chair of the Wisconsin Election Commission defends the decision to move forward with the April 7th election. We look at how it could be impacted by the Safer at Home order. Then, Italy's funeral homes are struggling to keep up with respectful burial practices during this pandemic. How prepared are we in Wisconsin?
Every religion, they have their own ceremonies. We respect that. But in this time of disaster, if in fact we exceed our capacity, those things will have to be mitigated.
And at a time when senior living facilities are being placed on lockdown, we explore the effects of senior isolation.
Connect with your loved one, check in, even if it's a telephone call. There's so many individuals who say, I look forward to my son calling, for instance. That really can make a difference.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. Governor Tony Evers has ordered people to stay home. He made the Safer at Home order Monday morning, explaining only workers providing essential care and services should be going out. It's unclear how long the order will be in place and how it may impact the April 7th election. Despite some calls to delay, the State Election Commission has decided to proceed. Early voting has been stopped, and the three Milwaukee voting locations were closed over the weekend. Election officials are calling for everyone to get an absentee ballot when possible. The deadline to request an absentee ballot online instead of going to the polls has been extended by a federal court to March 30th after a lawsuit was filed by state and national Democrats. Lake Effect's Mayon Silver spoke with the GOP-appointed chair of the bipartisan Wisconsin Election Commission, Dean Knutson. He explains why he thinks it's a good idea to move ahead with the election.
The Wisconsin Election Commission believes it's vitally important that our April 7th election goes on as scheduled because we need to provide continuity in local government across Wisconsin. Wisconsin's different from some other states that are having presidential primaries only, in that in Wisconsin, we hold our spring nonpartisan election to elect local mayors and city council members, village board members, and county board members across the state. And these terms end in the spring. They start in the third week in April and they end 2 years later, typically, in the third week in April. And during a crisis, is exactly when it's important that we have our local officials in place, in office, ready to deal with the crisis.
And so do you anticipate any sort of circumstance in which the election would be moved?
In Wisconsin, our election laws are complex, like every state. And they're interrelated. So making what seems to be on the surface a simple move in one or two areas often has rippling effects that go outward. For example, we have myvote.wi.gov, a very simple and efficient way for voters to check on their registration status, to request a absentee ballot. And we're really encouraging that all Wisconsin voters request an absentee ballot through the myvote.wi.gov site and return the ballot by mail. I think we will be able to provide for sanitation practices during the in-person registration and balloting parts of the election. I don't believe that we need to change the date. And I don't believe personally that we need to have legislation or emergency legislation in order to change the way that this election runs. We can do it under the current laws, and it will be a challenge, but our clerks across Wisconsin are used to rising up to big challenges.
And when you say changing emergency legislation, are you talking about things that would maybe push back absentee deadlines, you know, to request and to file, that kind of thing?
There have been many proposals Again, many of them seem like common sense. But when we look at it, and our Elections Commission staff has looked at all the ramifications of those moves, and they lead to further problems. For example, in Wisconsin, we used to allow ballots to come in and be counted days after the election as long as they were postmarked. The legislature specifically debated that and specifically changed the law in Wisconsin to no longer allow that practice. There's no reason to think that right now we need to go back and undo what the legislature specifically considered and adopted. Our job is to administer the election under the laws that are enacted by the legislature. The governor and the legislative leaders have not indicated at this point that they intend to make a change. I don't think a change is needed in that. In fact, I think it will be better for our clerks. We have over 1,800 separate clerks in Wisconsin. This is very different from other states. We have a very decentralized election administration process. We have over 1,800. And to train up even to communicate a last-minute change in the rules can run the risk that it makes things more complicated, that then the fair and uniform administration of the election is altered in the process because they can't adapt fast enough to that. So instead, it will be safer and preferable if we keep our same election procedures, but instead we're going to use social distancing within the CDC has put out specific guidelines for polling places and how to handle this at polling places. We'll be looking at those as well as guidance from our own Department of Health Services. And we can run this election safely and fairly and have a result that everyone can rely on that allows our local officials to take office in a timely manner.
And what do you think are the key steps that Wisconsin Elections Commission is taking to ensure that that happens?
So we've developed best practices, and we're communicating those out to our clerks, ways to minimize potential viral transmission. We urgently requested the governor and our Department of Health Services to help us secure a supply of sanitation resources, hand sanitizer, and the like. We authorized the commission staff to spend up to $200,000 on additional absentee voting envelopes and supplies, as well as sanitation supplies, and we feel like we've found a source and we'll have plenty of those. So again, we really strongly encourage all Wisconsin voters to request an absentee ballot and to return the ballot by mail. This will mean fewer people in the polling place on election day, and it means that we'll be able to maintain better spacing and carry out a safer election. We've also directed all our municipal clerks that they need to follow the law to accommodate in-person absentee voting. It's the Wisconsin method of early voting and registration in person, but that they can be flexible in making changes as dictated by their local circumstances as to the location and the hours and the processes that they use. These items were all adopted by the Elections Commission unanimously yesterday, and we'll continue to be developing those best practices and communicating those out to our clerks.
And what about those citizens who may be in a health, maybe in quarantine?
So two things. We do allow curbside voting in Wisconsin for individuals with disabilities that would make it difficult for them to enter the polling place. We have given guidance that individuals that are currently ill, whether you have a fever, cough, don't feel like you really should be with others, that constitutes a disability under these circumstances, and we will accommodate you with curbside voting. So that's one. For someone who's quarantined, they can still request an absentee ballot just like anybody else can through the website. by emailing their clerk, by calling or faxing the clerk. There are a lot of ways for them to get ballots and vote. We do also have a process for hospitalized voters where it happens right in the last few days before the election that, you know, they've become hospitalized. So our election processes in Wisconsin that have been in place for previous elections will work well to manage the circumstances of this election as well.
And you don't think that the influx of absentee ballots, that people may have never voted absentee before, and there's so many absentee ballots that clerks have to go through and process, do you think that's going to be a problem in this election?
I think that the increased number of absentee ballots presents a challenge, as I said, both in the supplying them, handling the increased volume. But it has been steadily increasing with each election over a number of years. Our clerks are very accustomed to that. I think all of them are also of the opinion that this is the safest way to conduct an election right now. And we're very pleased that we're a state that's had no excuse absentee voting and has seen the steady increase in the number of voters that have taken advantage of voting by mail. So I think that's going to work well for us.
What about the likelihood of depressed turnout from voters who may not know how to process absentee ballots, like in terms of the fact that they need it to get it witnessed? Some voters may not know that. Some voters may not have internet access. Some voters may not have had the ability to register, getting a photo ID online, that kind of thing. And so it's requiring them to go into the polls where they may have health concerns.
Well, it's requiring them to complete that registration with the clerk. Where and how that happens is something that is up to the clerks to work out. And if there are special circumstances, the clerk can work with them to accomplish that. You asked about will these circumstances depress turnout? It is possible that our turnout in this election is lower than what we've seen before. That could happen. But turnout in our spring elections can vary greatly. Sometimes we have only the local races, and in some communities there's a hot race and in others there isn't, and it can vary greatly. Sometimes we have a Supreme Court election on the ballot and sometimes not. In this case, I think earlier in the presidential primary process, the thought was that the Democratic presidential primary might still be a very hot item. Currently, it doesn't really look like that'll be the case. And so I think the turnout for people that wanted to vote in that may very well be less, because that may be essentially over by the time we get to April 7th, and in which case many of the voters, that's what they cared about, know that spring voters vary a lot in how often they participate in that election.
So all in all, you feel like the way things are, the election is happening, and that's the right choice.
There are challenges presented to everyone across the country right now, whether it's in your home, whether it's in your workplace, your church, or at City Hall. But just like we haven't stopped going to the gas station to get gas and dealing with a clerk there, or going to the grocery store to get groceries and dealing with a clerk there, elections are vital to our democracy and self-governance in our society. And it's at least as important to vote as it is to go get gas or go get groceries. So, yes, I do believe that our election, it's already underway. We've had hundreds of thousands of requests for absentee ballots, and I believe we'll probably set an all-time record for a spring election for that. And those are all positive things. The election should go forward. We need it to ensure continuity of local government in Wisconsin.
Wisconsin Elections Commission Chair Dean Knutson, thank you for speaking with me about this.
Thank you.
Dean Knutson is the chair of the Wisconsin Election Commission. He spoke with WUWM's Mayon Silver. If you'd like to request an absentee ballot, you can find information at our website, wuwm.com. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers. In times of crisis, most public attention is given to prevention and mitigation. But in places like Italy, which has struggled with its response to the coronavirus pandemic, local officials are now struggling to bury the dead. Like hospitals, Italian mortuaries are over capacity. While fatalities from COVID-19 are still relatively low in the U.S., projections from the CDC suggest we could experience somewhere between 200,000 to 1.7 million deaths by the end of this pandemic. In Milwaukee County, that could mean somewhere between 600 to 5,000 deaths in the area. So, are we ready? Robin Gershon is a clinical professor of epidemiology at New York University, and she's the author of one of the few studies on mass fatality preparedness in the United States. She joins Lake Effect's Julian Haida.
First things first, as somebody who studied disaster response, how often do public officials consider the back end of this? Obviously, priorities are on saving lives when you can, but once a certain amount of the public has died, how prepared are local governments, state governments, and the federal government to respectfully handle the remains and identify the remains of people who have died in any sort of unexpected situation?
Well, we actually in this country have a very robust, what we call mass fatality infrastructure. And that infrastructure is made up of several important key sectors that all have been preparing. The problem that we found when I conducted my research is that sometimes the plans have not been updated for years. Sometimes they don't have the necessary resources they need to fulfill those plans, operationalize those plans. And so, therefore, the system is not ideal. It's not, as you're putting it, at the back end. It's at the back end. It's not in the forefront of a lot of our planning in this country.
Right, and a lot of us are thinking of preparedness, and a lot of us are thinking about, hospital capacity. But again, on the back end, we think of county coroner's offices, medical examiners, even your local mortuary that might only have room for 4 or 5 bodies, or in the case of a county, maybe a few dozen. And, due to a number of factors, a lot of local jurisdictions are operating at capacity. So what is the risk of being unprepared for a situation such as the one we're seeing, where there could be a 10 to 40% increase in fatalities in a particular area?
Well, the good thing is that, in general, we are very prepared for the capacity, even with some kind of disaster event. Even some of our worst disasters, where we had several hundred, even a couple of thousand, 3,000, we have capacity for that. We have to bring in all of our resources, for sure. But, for instance, in 9/11, we had a lot of local capacity, and we had to call in additional capacity, and we were able to manage it. But something like Sandy Hook, for instance, which had 28 deaths in 2012, that was in Connecticut, a small town, it took the services of well over a dozen different funeral homes to handle that. And, of course, the capacity of every single forensic pathologist in the state to help do those autopsies. Now, when we think about these mass fatalities, we have to remember the actual pathologist, the medical examiner, pathologist, they only have to do an autopsy when it's a homicide, a suicide, an accident, or some kind of unusual kind of event. So in a case like we're seeing now, where we have a lot of deaths from this pandemic, where we may have a lot of deaths, we haven't really fortunately had that many yet, but if we have a lot, they would not need to be autopsied. So that will be somewhat spared. However, it will go downstream to the funeral directors. That is where, as you rightly put it, there might be some problems with capacity, and that I think is totally true.
I want to ask also about the fact that a lot of the disasters that we're used to handling in the United States are localized. You mentioned the Sandy Hook tragedy. You mentioned 9/11. There are hurricanes and earthquakes that we're familiar with on our coasts. This is a little different in the sense that there are cases of the coronavirus in every state. Is the nature of this particular kind of possible mass fatality event a little bit different on what the system is used to handling?
That's a good point and very true. You know, we have so many national response teams. We have the medical response teams, you know, even teams that have psychologists and nurses. And we do have this thing called the disaster mortuary response team. And these are people that can go out to wherever they're needed to assist. I believe that they did respond when we had 9/11. I think it was more local help. It was local help when it was in Connecticut in 2012. But in this case, we don't really need, like, pathologists or, you know, forensic pathologists. What we need are people that can do funeral home work. They can take the deceased and bring them to the funeral home. They could host the services, they can counsel the families, they can bury the dead. And I've done studies on funeral home capacity, and they are limited. They are very limited. And there are some national funeral companies, and they could probably bring in resources from another area. But as you so rightly pointed out, this is something affecting every area pretty much. So spreading them out to go to another area is not going to be effective for us. We can't take them from part, you know, point A to bring them to point B if we really need them in point A. So I think that is where our system is going to be severely challenged. If, in fact, we do have some of these estimates, modeled numbers of decedents at the end of this pandemic.
We understand that it'll come down to the local funeral home, the local mortuary, to possibly deal with this issue, unlike in a, for example, a kind of a disaster scenario. But I'm curious, a lot of people, for example, use funeral homes for family gatherings. They use funeral homes for, as the name implies, funerals. And, you know, in this situation, people aren't really able to gather. People aren't able to mourn. So what are the cultural expectations of handling large amounts of fatalities, handling bodies in situations that respect the families of the next of kin while also handling large amounts of bodies?
Right now, we have been told no gatherings of more than 10 people. So right away, we know that large funeral services, that's going to be out of the question. So that is not going to happen. But in terms of, let's say, the final disposition of these bodies is going to be problematic because when I did my funeral home director study, the death care industry study, so that is the whole gamut of the death care industry, including the companies that supply mortuary supplies, equipment, chemicals, that sort of thing. And that also includes cemeteries and also includes crematories. And our capacity in that regard was very low. We have very full up cemeteries right now, and we have very limited build capacity for crematories. And that becomes, I think, a real problem of how do we do this final disposition of bodies when we have, or human remains, where we have a lot of death. That's going to be a challenge.
I was reading that in Iran, they're struggling with this, and they're digging trenches, which is, of course, I'm sure, very difficult for the families of the deceased. In Italy, you know, this is a place where the medical system is very good, but they've had a hard time keeping pace with the amount of fatalities. And some mortuaries in northern Italy are, for example, leaving caskets at homes and instructing people to do home funerals. Is this a scenario that you think might be possible in terms of people having to handle a certain amount of the disposition on their own, at the very least if they want to avoid something like a mass burial, such as in Iran, giving an individual their due, as we expect culturally, a single person burial?
Yeah. I mean, in this country, we have an incredibly strong sense of ethics regarding respect for the decedent and compassion for the bereaved. It is one of our tenets of our culture, regardless of what religion, race, creed, any of that. Every religion, they have their own ceremonies. It's very important to them. We respect that and we honor that. But in this time of disaster, if in fact we exceed our capacity, those things will have to be mitigated in some way. And certainly bringing caskets to people's homes so they can have their own private service, I really don't see that as a feasible situation because, for one thing, we depend on the funeral home for those kinds of things, and they have very, very limited staff. It's a very aging workforce. It's not exactly an employment area that has very heavy growth. Young people are not gravitating to work in funeral homes. So there's already a shortage in an aging workforce. They simply won't have the capacity, the manpower, womanpower to handle that. So what will we do? It'll probably come down to, I think, I hope that the funeral homes can handle the preparation of the body in whatever religious way the family wants. And then somehow they're going to have to probably put them in kind of holding areas for final disposition in a cemetery where they have space. I can't even imagine enough grave diggers if some of these statistics to actually come true. Some of the modeling becomes true. So resorting to these mass burials, I think, is very problematic for the American people. It's going to be difficult. People in our country typically like to go someplace or have the ashes of their dead ones. They want to mourn them and they want to remember them and they like to have a place to go, even if it's just a little spot where the ashes are in some, you know, cemetery. Hopefully we won't get to that point, but I think it could be problematic.
And you mentioned ashes, cremation. I think a lot of people don't realize that could take 1 to 3 hours.
Oh, yeah. When we did our study, and I was getting background intel for the actual survey document, I went to visit several cemeteries and crematory, and it turned out the crematory was kind of north of the city. So this is a city of 8.6 million. There was one working crematory within driving distance, like within a day, and they had only 5 of the, what I think they call them, retorts, and they had a throughput of about 25 bodies or human remains a day.
So that's a 24-hour cycle, it seems, in a city 10 times bigger than Milwaukee.
Right. So that is a real point of where things can really slow down. You know, people need to mourn, and they need to mourn appropriately. And for some of them, it's in a funeral home with their family, and afterwards they break bread together, they remember the TV. I mean, these things are important for our mental health.
Yeah, especially in a time that is so stressful. Well, Robin Gershon, clinical professor of epidemiology at the School of Global Public Health at New York University, thank you so much for joining us and discussing this difficult topic of how to pay respects to the people who have perished from the coronavirus.
Thank you so much. You're the first reporter, and I've had contact with quite a few. You're the first one to think about this. I think you're way ahead of the curve, and I think you're smart to do it.
Oh, well, thank you. You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM 89.7 Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Julian Haida. Well, we heard the worst-case scenario right there, with coroners and mortuaries in places like New York, Cleveland, Indianapolis, and other cities operating at or over capacity on a good day. So how does Milwaukee stack up? I recently spoke with Mark Krause, the owner of Krause Funeral Home, which operates several Milwaukee locations. I started by asking him how things might change locally in the age of coronavirus.
One of the unforeseen maybe advantages of all this is this will give people time to process that death more. So often a death occurs and people move, I think, often too quickly to do things because they think that's what they're supposed to do. Experience has taught me if people slow down a little bit, take it in and do things, maybe over the course of a week or 10 days or 2 weeks even, because there's no, once someone dies, there's no hurry to do anything.
Right.
It allows them to process the meaning of that death to them. And it gives them time to do those tasks that they need to do.
Yeah. Now, it seems like one of the other issues with that might contribute to the delay is an issue of capacity. I want to be very careful not to be alarmist, but the CDC is saying there could be as many as 200,000 to close to even 2 million deaths as a result of this. Now, we obviously hope that that won't be the case, but locally that means that we could see a 10 to 40% increase in the amount of remains that are being handled. How well do you think local funeral homes or such as your funeral home are prepared to store remains, to have them transported with such an unexpected increase in capacity?
I think that Milwaukee has the ability to handle that well. Milwaukee is one of the older cities in essence, and we have a lot of funeral homes compared to other cities, especially the cities more west of Wisconsin. And as you move east, there tends to be more funeral homes that do less volume. So I think what you have is more capacity for some of those things. Personally, as a funeral home, we're well-equipped to deal with that volume increase.
That's good to hear. I'm also interested in the sense that CDC predictions say that a lot of hospital beds will be taken up, so some people will have to fight this virus from home. And say someone is helping or living with a loved one who is struggling with the coronavirus at home, and they do unfortunately pass away. What advice do you have for them, whether it be from this virus or just a death at home, in reaching out to a death care professional such as yourself?
Well, I think one of the keys for most people, and it's a hard one, but is to find out what you need to know before it happens. Often when a death occurs and people are unprepared, they're operating in a triage mode because they just don't know what to do. It doesn't hurt to at least make some phone calls and to get some initial information. Number one, think about what funeral home that you would like to use and give them a call and ask them what is necessitated. Now, I do know with the coronavirus right now, the Milwaukee Medical Examiner, if you're in Milwaukee County, or Waukesha, or any of them, they are the ones that will be required, even if you're under doctor's care, to sign the death certificate if that was the cause of death. That's in statute.
Now, you mentioned the medical examiner's office. We reached out for them for comment, and we hope to hear back from them. But I'm curious about the infrastructure that you have to deal with on a daily basis. You know, we talked about capacity just a second ago. A retort where cremations happen, they take a long time.
Well, they can.
And so does digging graves. So how do you think, that time aspect will play into, an unexpected increase in a kind of disaster scenario in our area?
I think there may be minimal delays, but I don't think it's anything that will be too alarming. Milwaukee has a number of crematories, and we're fortunate, Crowley Funeral Home, we're one of the few that actually we have two of our own crematories.
And how many cremations do you usually handle on a given day?
Oh, a given day? Well, I do know annually, every day varies, but annually we're over 700 plus cremations. So I guess that comes out to about two a day, and we have the capacity to handle quite a bit more than that.
So it certainly does sound like Milwaukee County, your funeral home included, is very well prepared, because in New York City, on an average day, there could be 10 to 12 cremations in a place that only has three retorts. So So you do have that opportunity to give the individual care and attention to individual bodies.
Yeah. Oh, yes, absolutely. We can easily handle 6 to 8 cremations a day with our availability, just our funeral home. And there's a few others around town also. So there is the capacity to have. And truth be told, some of this, you know, the medical examiner issues permits. And so we're often held by when they issue the cremation permits. We can't cremate until they issue one. We're in Wisconsin, we have to wait 48 hours after death before we can cremate. We can't cremate until they give us a release. And so those are all little roadblocks along the way that happen. And sometimes the doctor is involved, and the doctor has 5 days to sign a death certificate. So that might be complicating that delay also.
And I've read that, for example, you know, more than half of American funerals now involve cremation, whereas 100 years ago, during the 1918 Spanish flu epidemic, they recruited seminarians to dig graves, but that was at a time when almost everybody had a full body burial in a cemetery in an individual plot. So things are a little bit different these days.
Correct. And they dig graves much more quickly now. They have machinery in place. So the delays and things like that won't, while there may be some, I don't think they will be huge or vastly obstructive to what people need to have done.
Well, Mark Krause, president owner of Krause Funeral Home and Cremation, thank you so much for joining us and talking through this very difficult subject in this time when people are really struggling to get by.
Yes, they are. And God bless all of us, and we will get through this, and we will all do it together.
After this interview was recorded, the Milwaukee County Medical Examiner affirmed Mark Krause's point on being prepared for mass deaths in the area. In addition to hospitals and funeral homes, they have room to store about 75 human bodies above their current capacity. Coming up, we'll look at the impact of social isolation on seniors. You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. Listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers. More people are isolating themselves due to the COVID-19 pandemic, but isolation and loneliness have long been concerns for some seniors. A recently released study by the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine urged the healthcare system to do more to identify and prevent problems related to senior isolation. UW-Milwaukee Applied Gerontology Professor Colleen Galambos helped write the report. She joins WUWM innovation reporter Chuck Quirnbach and starts by defining the terms isolation and loneliness.
So there are a couple of really key distinctions. Isolation is measured by the amount of contacts or connections that you have with individuals. So somebody can have a few really good friends but feel very, very connected because the relationships are quality relationships and they have a lot going on. Loneliness, however, is more of a subjective feeling that you may be living in an assisted living facility, a nursing home, or you may be living with family but still feel lonely because those quality relationships and connections are not there.
Is there any way of knowing if loneliness among seniors is increasing?
Well, we know that a significant proportion of adults in the United States, 35% of adults 45 and older, and 43% of adults age 60 and older report feeling lonely.
Why do people, at least among seniors, why do people sort of get into that loneliness track? What happens in their lives typically?
It has to do with maybe a person's inability to make those strong social connections that we talked about. That may be a result of mental health issues, physical impairments, not feeling comfortable being around people, and all those kinds of factors can really impact. As well as we're also noticing that people who are caregivers are also in a situation where, because they're so busy with the caregiving activities, they can't take care of themselves and really participate in those quality interactions.
maybe the statistics show it, but is loneliness a bigger problem for seniors than for younger folks?
What I'll say to that is that older adults are more predisposed to some of the factors that would create situations in which a person feels disconnected. And that would be like the loss of family and friends, retirement, chronic illness, and sensory impairments.
You were a member of a committee for the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine that wrote a report about social isolation and loneliness among seniors. And one of the conclusions was that the medical system could do more to help these folks. Is that right? Can you talk a little bit about what the healthcare system can do? A couple key points.
Well, one of the things that I'd like to mention is when we look at this whole issue of social isolation and loneliness, there are people in the community that are isolated and lonely that we don't know about. But one of the places where they do connect with individuals is often the healthcare system. So if the healthcare system can be more aware that people may be suffering from isolation and loneliness, perhaps do an assessment or screening, that would really go a long way to at least identifying people who are at risk and then helping to connect them with interventions and programs that may help them.
What form might that screening take?
That's a good question. We're looking at something that would be fairly short because physicians and medical personnel are screening for lots of different things. So maybe a 3 or 4 item questionnaire. We would suggest that it be evidence-based, that that there's evidence to prove that it does measure social isolation and loneliness, and that be conducted as part of a general regular screening.
Can it be difficult to get seniors to admit they're lonely? Can it be tough to get anyone to admit they're a little bit lonely?
Well, surprisingly, people will admit that if they have the capability to. So if you're working with an individual who has, say, cognitive impairment and they're having difficulty answering questions generally, then this type of screening tool probably would not be very helpful. In that case, you might want to go to the caregiver, their designated legal representative to help get some additional information about the individual.
Maybe we should address the age range. Is loneliness a bigger problem for once you get over 80, or is it 70 to 80? Is there a way of sort of breaking down the age difference?
The committee did not study that particularly because there's really not a lot of evidence out there that breaks it down that way. But my response to you would be if we know the predisposing factors are things like physical impairments, sensory impairments, cognitive functioning impairments, those may increase with age, and as people are confronted with multiple losses, that does put them at risk for isolation and loneliness.
If the screening would show some problems or some isolation, unwanted isolation, what next could the medical system do?
At that point, to connect that individual with programs that, again, show evidence that they can reduce isolation and loneliness. Now, one of the challenges that we have in this country is that we have a lot of programs out there who purport to be the panacea for reducing isolation and loneliness. But in terms of research, we haven't had a lot of programs that systematically are testing that out. There are some programs out there that seem to be promising, such as telephone reassurance programs, some technology interventions.
Are there any ethical or privacy concerns with trying to take a more active role in at least diagnosing or interacting with seniors?
Yes, there are a few things that we have to consider. One is how do we share that information and share that information that we receive from the patient in a way that the patient is fully aware and consents to the sharing of such information? How do we protect that information so that people who should not have access to it are not getting access to it? So, for instance, if someone is living alone and they're purported as being lonely and living alone, that's really not information that you want the general public to know. You want to keep that private.
And if the information was shared with other family members, that could maybe spark a negative conversation among the family, could it?
It could. And again, I think we need to take the lead from the patient or the person who is in that situation. Who do they feel comfortable sharing that information with, asking them, and then sharing information with the people that they designate as it being all right. The other concern that we have to be careful about is that when we measure social isolation and loneliness, we are truly using assessment tools that measure that. So, for instance, for a long time, we assumed that people who were living alone were isolated and lonely. But we know, I'm sure you know, there are a number of people in our lives who live alone, and they are perfectly comfortable with that and are very strongly connected with other individuals.
In the healthcare system, it's often more than doctors. Is there a role for other people besides doctors to play here?
Definitely. We really are suggesting a team-based approach to care. So pull in your social workers and your nurses who are very able to conduct some of the assessments and screenings for social isolation and loneliness. And also, social workers are key at connecting people with community resources in the event that somebody does screen at risk. A social worker is a good person to be able to connect to community resources that are out there. In addition to that, I think your rehab personnel, your physical therapist, occupational therapist, speech therapist also play a role in assessing and screening for social isolation and loneliness. So this issue or problem is not only the issue or problem of the physician, but of the healthcare team. So if we can take a team-based approach to care, including coordinated solutions between the healthcare system and community-based social care providers, that will go a long way to addressing this issue.
Is there anything else the healthcare system can do that you want to address?
Training and education is going to be critical to really tackling this issue. We do believe that this issue is approaching public health status, that it is a public health problem. So that the more that we can educate people who are working in the field about this issue, and the more that we can help them learn how to assess for isolation and loneliness, the more that we can help them understand the difference between social connections and loneliness, that's going to go a long way to help resolve the issue and problem. And also bringing educational programs into our schools so that students who are learning to work with older adults understand the best way to assess and screen for isolation and loneliness.
We hear that the medical profession is quite busy, especially in these days of coronavirus. How can we add to the knowledge in the medical community without burdening them?
That's a good question. It goes back to how can we provide information to them in a succinct manner? Can we use multiple sources of media, such as webinars as well as conferences, public information awareness sites, websites that people can go to, integrate some of that information into professional associations so that they can get the word out as well, would be some ways that we can get the message out that would not be so overly burdensome.
Aside from the healthcare system, what steps can seniors take on their own to reduce isolation if they want to?
If they want to, get involved, find interest groups that you might want to participate in, join community civic programs, look for programs and activities in places of worship. These are all places that would welcome seniors.
What advice do you have for families who want to help seniors in this way, especially if the senior citizen is tentative?
Connect with your loved one, check in, even if it's a telephone call. There's so many individuals who say, I look forward to my son calling, for instance, and I look forward to that weekly call or that daily call. That really can make a difference. Try to suggest activities, maybe attend an activity with your loved one if they're reluctant. But also be careful about not forcing activities. If somebody has not been a joiner all of their life, they're not going to be a joiner when they turn 65 or 75 or 80. So what would be some activities that that person could get involved in that would be more in line with their personality?
We haven't talked about the social or economic cost if changes aren't made, what can unwanted isolation lead to in the way of additional health problems or societal cost?
Well, we do know that over four decades of research has produced evidence to say that scoring high on measures of social isolation is associated with an increased risk for early death. So when you look at that, that will involve a number of healthcare issues or problems that the individual would be faced with. So both being at risk for multiple medical problems and mental health problems would potentially increase people's use of healthcare. Now, I will tell you that the literature on that is mixed. Sometimes people will use healthcare systems more to try to take care of their issues that are presenting. But sometimes, because people are isolated and lonely, they may not connect as much with healthcare systems.
And there could be then emergency room visits where a checkup might have taken care of a problem.
That's correct. That's correct. Or maybe long-term rehabilitation because the illness has gotten so severe.
Colleen Galambos is a professor of applied gerontology at UW-Milwaukee. She spoke with WUWM's Chuck Kornbach. Galambos says the AARP Foundation paid for the National Academy's report on senior isolation, but had no say over the committee's findings. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh air is next.